friend McCormack, a decent sort of guy and a very experienced miner, would tell how he knew, looking into the crazed eyes of the Russian, that the giant would have snapped his neck like a chicken bone and thrown him back down the entry shaft had he taken a step towards the grizzly. He felt a lot better about not examining the accident site when the electrician returned after setting up the lights to report that the rescue was futile. There was absolutely no chance of my having survived. Rasputin had allowed the rigger, a Yugoslav simply known as Zoran, to remain, and had demanded that his own gang, only just rested from hauling timbers, be sent up to him. Maintaining his furious though measured pace, he timbered up the shaft above the grizzly. 3 hours passed before it was safe to enter the shaft, where I lay buried. Rasputin, his woolen miner's vest and the shirt over it soaked with perspiration, paused only briefly to drink a canteen of water before allowing himself to be lowered by the hoist the Yugo had rigged to the rock covering me nearly 50 feet below. Working with great grunts, he started to fill the hoist basket, giving a short, sharp whistle each time the basket was ready to be hauled up. With Rasputin safely down the shaft, McCormack and the remainder of the rescue crew, together with the 3 grizzly men, had crowded into the grizzly area. The white men worked with the blacks to empty the basket and pass the rock along fire bucket style to the air escape shaft. The Russians' work proved to be a model rescue operation, and McCormack set up the oxygen tent and the transfusion apparatus he knew the mine medic would want when eventually he arrived. McCormack would have liked to have sent an African down every 10 minutes, about the time it took to exhaust a man lifting rocks, some of which weighed as much as 50 pounds. He knew Rasputin would not allow this. An African, careless or inexperienced, might cause a rock slide, impacting the rock which lay over me even further. Until he actually lifted my body and held my chest to his ear, Rasputin was not going to accept my death. Men, especially miners, who live in the constant shadow of death, do not stand mute-voiced and solemn for hours at the scene of an accident. The look one sees on the gawking faces of people surrounding a road accident victim is not the same as the one worn by miners. Miners carry their grief in an outwardly matter-of-fact way, each man a silent repository of his own feelings, each grizzly man knowing his name may well be on the next card in a stacked deck. Mick Spillane, known of course as Mickey Spillane, an illiterate Irishman who had been in the school of mines with me, and who had only just volunteered to come back onto grizzlies in an attempt to pay his gambling debts, was the first to start the betting.
"The Ruskie won't make it, I'm telling you now, lads."
"I reckon he will, man," someone else said. Probably Van Veik, the Afrikaner. Suddenly everyone was in on the betting. Even Elijah, who had refused to leave the grizzly level when my gang had been relieved, was allowed to put £5, a week's wages, on the Russian getting to my body before he collapsed. Mickey then offered odds of 50-1 on my being alive, and this time only the little African took the bet, putting another week's wages on the talisman, who had kept them all alive over almost 9 months. Most of the men bet against Rasputin lasting the distance, and the bets between the dozen or so whites present amounted to nearly £2,000. When, years later, I told Jaime of the incident, asking him how he would have bet, he had laughed. "The Irishman was right. Only I'd have offered 200-1 against your making it. But it would have shortened the odds on the Russian." Rasputin's tremendous energy was beginning to give out. He was digging deep for the strength to keep going, his breathing labored and rasping. When the basket was filled, he could no longer summon up the breath to whistle. Zoran, watching from the top, would start to lift the basket, whereupon the giant would stoop down, his huge hands raw and bleeding, clasping his knees. Once he threw up, and once he removed his torn shirt and miner's vest, and tearing strips from the shirt, bound his bloody hands. But always, as the bucket lowered, he was ready to start loading again. Several of the men had offered to replace him, but he'd simply shaken his head.
"Нет, нет," he gasped.
Soon the flinted edges of the broken rock he was lifting cut into his chest and stomach. His dirt-covered torso, caught in the light from the single electric bulb burning directly above him, glistened with blood and raw exposed flesh, his stomach muscles pumping red. The men above watched fascinated, waiting for the moment when the giant would collapse.
"He's done for,"
I'm telling you now. Half a ton more and he's history,
Mickey whispered, even though there was no chance of the Russian hearing him or even understanding his heavy brogue. What they were witnessing was a great feat of strength, and they told each other they would one day tell their grandchildren of this night. It must have been about this time when Rasputin heard me groan, though how he would have done so over his rasping breath was a miracle. He gave a sharp, agonized cry and threw himself at the rock in the area from which the sound had come. No longer bothering about the basket, he tore the rock aside, frantically stacking it behind him. He worked, possessed by the devil himself, Mickey later claimed. Rasputin was finding strength to continue from beyond the realm of normal human consciousness, his breath coming in short animal snorts, like a pig sniffing for truffles. The blood streamed from his chest and stomach, soaking the top of his pants down to the knees, while the ragged bandages were ripped from hands reduced to raw slabs of meat. When he finally reached me, wedged miraculously under the narrow though protective ledge, my body was soaked in blood, as it turned out from large sections of skin which had been removed in the fall. Rasputin lifted my unconscious body to his chest and placed his ear to my heart.
"PK, he live!" he wailed.
Slowly he sank to the ground, his legs no longer able to hold him. We sat in a nest of rock like the one the loneliness birds laid deep inside me, my head resting in the giant's blood-soaked lap. He'd severed his index finger at the first knuckle, and as he tenderly stroked my forehead, the blood from the stump ran down my brow and filled the cups made by my closed eyes. The hollows soon filled, then ran from the overflowing bowl down my cheeks. Rasputin tried to stop the flow, wiping at it with the stump of his severed finger, unaware of the real source of the blood.
"PK! Rasputin find PK! Rasputin make rabbit stew," he sobbed.
Later, Mickey Spillane would claim that when they got to us, there were tears of real blood coming from the giant's eyes. But by that time, he was already dead. I spent a week in hospital, most of it being treated for shock. The skin had been scraped from a large part of my body, and I was badly bruised, but not a single bone was broken. When I regained consciousness and heard of Rasputin's death, I wept, and then begged that they delay the burial until I could attend his funeral. In a hot climate, in a town without a mortuary, it wasn't possible, and the huge Georgian had been buried for 3 days when they released me from the cottage hospital. While I looked a mess, with both eyes blackened and the skin on each side of my face purple with scab, I was in excellent shape. My first task was to go to the general store in Luanshire and order a tombstone for Rasputin, a black granite slab which would have to come from Bulawayo more than 600 miles to the south and would take several weeks. On it would be written simply, "Rasputin, maker of excellent rabbit stew, who gave his life for his friend." I then went to the small cemetery where he lay under a mound of red clay. On top of the clay was a single wreath of battered gladioli. We were almost at the beginning of the rainy season, and it had rained a little the previous night, and the heavy drops of tropical rain had kicked up the red clay so that the pink and orange petals, opaque from being wet, were stained with mud. Rasputin loved wildflowers as Doc had loved aloe. Why is it that the ubiquitous gladioli always crowds everything else out? I dropped painfully to my haunches as the scab on the side of my leg stretched, and read the mud-splashed card on the wreath. R.I.P. The Management, Roan Antelope Mine. That was all. I had taken Rasputin's old shotgun with me, and now I rose, and lifting the old gun to my shoulder, I fired both barrels over his grave. It was a pointless gesture, I guess, and the kick of the gun into my bruised shoulder made me hop around in pain. But it was just the sort of thing which could happen in a Wednesday matinee Western, and of which I could see Rasputin thoroughly approving. The following day I returned to the grave, having loaded all Rasputin's wooden balls into the back of a borrowed utility. With a long-handled lasher's shovel I flattened the mound and buried the shotgun next to him. Then I built a pyramid over the grave using all the wooden balls. When I was finished, it stood 5 foot tall, Taking careful measurements, I had the welding shop at number 9 shaft make me a pyramid-shaped containing frame with small bars running parallel every 4 inches across the sides, so that the balls, while being clearly seen, could not be removed. The metal frame was completed in 2 days, and together with the help of Zoran the Yugo, I rigged a hoist over Rasputin's grave and dropped it neatly over the wooden balls, seating the corners into a cement footing. It made a very impressive tombstone, and when his headstone arrived, Rasputin's grave would be the pride of the tiny cemetery. Together with Zoran, who could speak a little Russian, we went through Rasputin's papers. There wasn't very much to tell of his past. Norwegian seaman's papers bearing his name, a Russian passport, and his discharge papers from the Russian Navy, which indicated he'd been a stoker. Finally, we found a sheet of paper on which a woman's name, similar to the one in his passport, was written. It was followed by an address in Russia. Zoran had said that a slight difference in surname was common in Russia, and I gathered he meant that this was a feminine version of the male surname. Rasputin's bank account came to nearly £7,000, and I arranged to send this to the name on the slip of paper, after taking Zoran with me and convincing the district magistrate that this was Rasputin's closest kin. A wife, a sister, or a mother? But at least someone, somewhere, other than me, who would remember him for the good fortune he had brought them. I had been visited in hospital by Fats Greer, the part-time insurance agent. He pushed a piece of paper in front of me. "Sign here, PK," he said, his pudgy finger indicating a blank line on the sheet of paper. I signed. "I need 2 checks for £20 each. Don't date them." To my surprise, he produced my checkbook. "Elijah, your number one boy, delivered your trawler bag to the mine captain after your accident. I took the liberty of using the keys in it." I nodded, still a bit dazed, and not really knowing what was happening. As far as I knew, he had refused to cover me for the last 3 months on Grizzlies. I signed the checks and asked him what it was all about. "I'll tell you when you feel a little better." He grinned. "The crazy Rusky gave you more than his life, son." A week later, I was to learn that Rasputin had a long-standing insurance policy with Fats Greer for £1,000 and had made me the benefactor. Fats also handed me a check for £500. "What's this for?" "Your accident, compo," he replied. "Check your check butts. You never missed a premium." He walked away, whistling to himself. It meant that I had no need to return to the mines for a further 3 months. As Solly Goldman would have put it, "You're home and hose, my son." With the money I had saved and Rasputin's legacy, I had sufficient funds for 3 years at Oxford. I also had enough left over to travel to London once a week for training by the famous Dutch Holland. Holland didn't usually take amateurs, but Jaime had sweet-talked him into allowing me to show my stuff. If he liked what he saw, he'd take me into the professional ranks under his care. I had 3 weeks' sick leave after coming out of hospital, and I knew that the best way to get rid of my bruises was to work my body. I put in a lot of road. I also rigged an extra-heavy homemade canvas punch bag the mine sailmaker had made for me. Hanging it from a rafter Zoran had reinforced on the veranda of my rondavo. Beside it hung the speedball and the lighter punching bag I had brought from South Africa, and on which I had worked out every day I had been at the mines. Speed was something I couldn't afford to lose, and while the work in the mines had built up my body so that I was by now almost a welterweight, I didn't want to forego speed for the extra power I had gained. The year away from boxing had been good for me. While I hadn't talked about it to anyone, even in the letters I wrote, the flame that lit my ambition to be welterweight champion of the world burned as fiercely as ever, and had never left me for even one single moment of any one day. In fact, when I regained consciousness in the hospital, I thought that I had been fighting for the world championship and that I had been knocked out. The disappointment I felt was enormous, and when I was fully conscious and aware of what had happened, I comforted myself with the knowledge that I now knew what it felt like to lose the world championship. It now only remained for me to experience winning it. I sweated out the aches and pains over 3 hard training sessions a day. Within a fortnight, the scabs were beginning to flake off, leaving large blotches of new pink skin all over my body, which made me look a little like an albino who'd been passed backwards through a meat grinder. My head had also been shaved to get it to cut on my skull, which had turned out to be pretty superficial and had only required 5 stitches. As Sully Goldman would say, I looked a proper Charlie. The mine required that I complete a final shift, though not on a grizzly, so that I could sign all my papers and be passed as completely fit again. This was so that I couldn't sue them at some later date for some real or imagined after-effect. I spent the last week of my sick leave writing home, to Miss Bornstein and Mrs. Boxall, and of course to Jaime, who had written to me weekly from Oxford. I also wrote to Geert and to Gideon Mandorma, who was already beginning to write quite well himself. Finally, I wrote to St. John Byrne, whose retirement from the Prince of Wales School coincided almost exactly with my own from the mines. They had all written regularly, with Miss Bornstein and Mrs. Boxall keeping up with Jaime, and St. John Byrne, to my constant surprise, wrote every 6 weeks or so. After his initial disappointment over my refusal to take a scholarship to a South African university, he had become imbued with the idea that I should make it to Oxford under my own steam, and had arranged for me to be accepted at Magdalen College with Jaime. I knew this final letter telling them all that I'd made it would be a big event for them. I was back on track, and all would be forgiven. The prodigal son had returned. I even wondered if old Mr. Bornstein might let me win another game of chess. There had been almost a full case of brandy left in Rasputin's hut, and I decided to take it up to the Crud Bar on the Saturday before my final workday on Monday. I left this quite late, not wishing to be seen much in public. I was quite well known around town because I played scrum half for the Luanshire rugby team, and had been selected on 3 occasions to play for the Copper Belt. It embarrassed me to be made a fuss of, and so I kept pretty much to myself. I intended to go to the Crud Bar just after 3 o'clock, when Fritz 1, 2 and 3 came on duty. The idea of going earlier, when the Mrs. Fritzes were doing the morning shift and being fussed over by the 3 fat fraus, was too much to contemplate. I planned to ask Fritz whoever to raffle off the case of brandy and to use the proceeds to buy ice cream for the kids at the Wednesday matinee in memory of Rasputin. I figured the brandy would more than likely raise enough money to pay for ice cream for several weeks. It was something I felt sure Rasputin would have liked. I had attended the last 2 Wednesday matinees, sitting in the same place Rasputin and I had sat. The kids had come in as usual and sat all around me. I groaned and moaned and shouted and generally carried on a treat in all the places the big Russian would have done. At first the kids did not respond, but I persisted, and soon they fell into the familiar mood and we all had a good time. Except at the end of the 1st Wednesday, I began to cry, which had spoilt it a bit for them. As usual, during interval, I bought ice creams all round, and the kids went along with the new game, knowing full well what I was attempting to do. When, at the 3rd Wednesday matinee, after Rasputin's death, I told them I would be leaving, 2 small boys had approached me.
"Don't you worry about Rusky's grave and the wooden balls and all. We'll look after them for you, PK,"
the larger of the two assured me.
"Yes, forever and ever,"
the smaller added. Rasputin's affairs were finally in the only hands he would have personally trusted. "You'll have to paint the metal pyramid frame every year, or it will rust away after a while," I said.
"What colour?"
the bigger one asked.
"Red, of course,"
the smaller answered. "Yes, red. That would do nicely," I said.
"You see, I told you, Russians like red,"
the small boy said in triumph. I lugged the case of brandy up to the Crud Bar. It was early yet, and only a handful of men were there. On the few occasions I had been in the bar, I had done my drinking with Fritz 3, and I now walked over to his section of the long bar and explained my purpose.
"Yeah, for sure we do this, but you must make the book,"
Fritz 3 replied emphatically, as though the idea had been his all along. Without my asking, he made up a large lemon squash with soda and a dash of bitters, the way I liked it.
"No, no, I don't want to bet. Just a raffle, Fritz 3. "Yeah, raffle. You make the book. Come, I show you."
He raised the bar panel to let me in behind the bar, and lifting the case of brandy, he indicated that I should follow him into a back room, which turned out to be an office. From a drawer he withdrew a staple gun, a roll of adding machine paper about 2 inches wide, an old Croxley fountain pen repaired with an inky piece of sticking plaster, scissors, an ink pad, and rubber stamp. Working quickly, he cut off a 4-inch length of paper and wrote the number 1 at each end of the strip, doing this until he had 20 strips of paper marked from 1 to 20, which he then stamped on the right-hand side with the rubber stamp, which read Luanshire Club, and stapled the opposite end to make a neat little book of raffle tickets.
Now we have one raffle book, yeah? You make like this for 500 tickets. Okie dokie?
I nodded and then told him that I wanted to buy 2 more bottles of brandy to complete the case.
No, Fritz buy, he said, jabbing his finger at his chest. Ruski he my friend.
He left me in the office and returned to his bar. I worked happily making tickets for an hour or so, creating a sophisticated version by using a large pin to punch a perforation line down the center of each book I completed, so the bit the customer retained could be parted easily. The noise in the bar grew steadily as more and more men came in. Making the raffle tickets was routine work, and I was soon lost in thought, oblivious to the noise outside. A soft though urgent whistle cut through my daydreaming. I looked up to see the large shape of Fritz III filling the doorway. I was immediately aware that there was silence in the crud bar. The fat German seemed agitated, his mouth working wordlessly and one hand hooking the air in an urgent gesture for me to approach. "What's wrong, Fritz?" He winced at the sound of my voice.
"Shh! You will be quiet, please. We have here some trouble, yeah?"
I rose and walked quietly towards him.
Porter, the diamond driller. He got powder headache and he go mad."
He stabbed his forefinger over his shoulder.
"If he find you, he will kill you,"
he whispered hoarsely.
"Shit, Fritz. Porter's my diamond driller. He wouldn't hurt me," I whispered back.
Fritz III grabbed me by the shirt front.
"He does this before. All men must bugger off from the crud bar when Porter drink the brandy, until he is kaput and falls on the floor. Yeah, this is when I call the hospital. If he catch you, he kill you, Piquet."
He pointed to the window.
"Please, you will jump now."
I moved over to the window and attempted to open it, but it had been nailed shut. Suddenly the snake was back in my mind's eye, its diamond-shaped head with tiny darting tongue, flicking faster than I could blink. I turned back at the sound of a cry of panic from Fritz III, to see his fat body jerked backwards into the bar beyond. A huge man, almost the size of Rasputin, rushed forward, crashing his forehead against the top of the doorway. He let out a roar of astonished pain, and blood ran from his head as he stooped to enter. His eyes were puffed and swollen and shot with blood. From his nostrils ran a thick trickle of yellow mucus.
"Come here, ye fucker!"
he roared as he came at me with both hands, bending forward slightly as though he were about to catch a trapped rabbit.
"It's me, Borta, it's PK, your grizzly man!" I shouted back at him.
The huge man seemed not to hear me.
"I kill you! I kill you, you bastard!"
His sleeves were rolled up almost to the top of the shoulder in the Afrikaans manner, and as he lunged at me I saw the tattoo. Under normal circumstances I would have easily avoided his clumsy lunge, but the shock of recognition caused me to freeze on the spot. Tattooed high up on Borta's left arm was a jagged, badly etched swastika. I had seen this tattoo before. On the judge. Borta, the judge now grown into a crazed giant of a man, grabbed my shirt front with one massive hand, and with the other he grabbed at the back of my belt. He lifted me from the ground, and moving through the door, he threw me over the long bar into the bar room beyond. I landed on all fours, but managed to break my fall with the butt of both hands. An anger so cold and fierce possessed me that I felt my mind would have to be torn from it, like a finger torn from dry ice. My concentration was so complete that the edges of the room disappeared, and the huge form of the judge as he climbed over the bar came into such sharp focus that at 10 feet I could see the individual hairs on his day-old stubble.
"First with the head and then with the heart. That why small can beat big."
It was Hoppy's voice that I heard in my head, and my resolve became a solid force, a pure, clean feeling totally controlled by my head.
Yapi Bota, come. Come, man, come. I've been waiting for you for most of my life.
There was a menacing growl in my voice I had not heard there before. Fritz III, back behind the safety of the long bar, screamed at me.
He been sniff Jellignite! He crazy! Run, Piquet! That boar kill you!
The judge dropped from the bar and with an angry roar charged towards me. A powder headache as severe as his could cause temporary insanity, and I knew he was capable of killing. I stepped to the side and hit him with a left uppercut hard on the nose, seating the punch deep, aware that the crude explosion of pain into the swollen sinus tissue would be devastating. A man my size would certainly have passed out from the blow. Bellowing like a wounded animal, the judge turned to face me again, blood and mucus running from his nose. I had waited a long time for this moment. I knew exactly what to do. The judge was the bull and I was the matador. It was I who would shape the fight. I knew suddenly that all of Giel Piet's footwork had been designed for this moment. It was time for the Klein Baas to dance. The judge was a man of around 25, but he had already let himself go around the middle, and his brandy gut hung over his belt. Years of working on a farm and then in the mines had built up his bulk, and he was probably at the height of his physical strength, but looking at him, I knew his condition was poor. With his sinuses already severely blocked, I would try to work on his mouth. If I could make him swallow enough blood as well as lead him into frequent charges, he'd soon be winded. My hands were strong from carving Rasputin's balls, and the skin and knuckles were hardened from the canvas punching bag I had worked with my bare fists. The judge charged repeatedly, and each time he came at me I stepped in with a lightning punch and hit him on the nose or in the mouth. Soon he was spitting a lot of blood, his chest heaving deeply as he tried to regain his breath. The salty blood would be mixing with the brandy in his stomach by now. Later I would put a Giel Piet 8 right into the nexus of the solar plexus, where all the nerve ends came together. He was beginning to move more slowly, trying to get me into a corner where he could crush me. I let him work me until he had my back right into the corner, and then I lifted my hands up as if I was going to plead for mercy. His punch came from 10 miles away. I ducked and weaved out of the corner as his huge fist smashed into the wall. His knuckles split, the bones in his wrist smashing through the skin, spattering blood all over the tiles as his wrist and hand broke. The cold rage inside me cocooned me into a circle of concentration, centered on the judge and myself. Like a Goya painting, only the action in the center mattered. The rest was blurred peripheral, belonging to another place and another time. I was unaware that the space behind the bar had filled. A couple of hundred miners were standing 3 deep along the 60-foot counter. The judge turned suddenly and lumbered toward the bar. Men pushed back in fear and collided with shelves and bottles of spirits which rained down on them. The judge grabbed a half-empty bottle of brandy from the counter which no one had thought to remove. He smashed it on the edge of the bar, sending a spray of brandy into his face, some of it going into his eyes and blinding him. The Giel Piet 8 went into the blinded man's gut, and I finished it off with an uppercut into his pulped and smashed nose. By the time he swung the broken bottle, I was clear again. The judge, as though in slow motion, fell to his knees and threw up onto the floor. The fight had been going nearly 20 minutes, and I hadn't said a word, my fury concentrated in both my hands. My knuckles were raw and bleeding from hitting him, but I felt nothing. As he sat there in his own vomit, a small child's voice cried out from somewhere deep inside my body.
"You killed Grandpa Chuck!"
The judge rose slowly to his feet, using the broken bottle to push himself up off the floor. His face was a bloody mess. Blood dripped from his broken hand and wrist. The front of his shirt stuck to his chest and stomach, soaked with brandy, blood, and vomit. He lifted his head and looked up at me. Through his broken lips he whispered the single word.
"Puskop!"
Using his remaining strength, he hurled the broken bottle at me, missing me by several inches. His useless broken hand and wrist hung at his side, and he swayed unsteadily on his feet. The Solly Goldman 13 went in, each punch deep and hard into the judge's gut. The hurl of vomit travelled 3 feet before it splashed to the floor as the judge collapsed, unconscious. My head exploded. The roar in my head was all white light. It was time for the heart. I was onto his body in a flash, straddling his torso. The snot and blood ran from his nose as his head rested on his right arm, just above the broken wrist. His left arm with the swastika tattoo faced me. I was unaware of having gone to my shorts, but Doc's Joseph Rogers pocket knife was open in my hand, the blade small but razor sharp. It struck high up on the arm where the mamba strikes, and sliced through the epidermis above the ragged swastika, the blade cutting a square about 4 inches across and 3 down. Then I crossed the square from corner to corner to make an X in a cross of St. Andrew, and then again from center to center to make the cross of St. George, cutting deep almost to the muscle. The blood, before it started to run down his arm, made a perfect Union Jack. Across the jagged blue lines of the swastika, I cut P.K. Then, smearing my hand into the mess on his shirt front, I rubbed it into the Union Jack and into the initials, knowing it would set up a massive infection and cause the keloid to build up on the arm. Nothing would ever remove the wide band of scar tissue which would form to make up the flag and the initials which cancelled the swastika. I wiped my hands and the blade of Doc's knife on the back of the judge's shirt and rose to my feet. Closing the blade of Doc's Joseph Rogers, I returned it to the pocket of my blood-splattered shorts.
"Rasputin thanks you for the brandy, Borta," I said, suddenly calm. I became aware of the men behind the bar. They hadn't moved and were silent, their eyes following me as I walked slowly towards the western-style saloon doors and then out of the crud bar. Outside, high above me, a full moon, pale as skimmed milk, floated in a day sky. I felt clean. All the bone-beaked loneliness birds banished. Their rocky nests turned to river stones. Cool, clear water bubbled over them. Streams in the desert.
That was the end of The Power of One, written by Bryce Courtney and read by Humphrey Bauer. This has been a Belinda Audiobooks production. Bryce Courtney, best-selling Australian author, wrote his first book, The Power of One, at the age of 55. It has now sold nearly 3 million copies worldwide, has been translated into 11 languages, and made into a movie of the same name. During a very successful advertising career, Bryce has won most of the local and international advertising awards, and in addition has won a gold medal for Best Documentary at the 1984 New York Film Festival. Committed to the cause of literacy and the importance of motivating young people to read, he is actively involved with literacy programs in primary schools Australia-wide. Bryce was born in 1933 in Johannesburg, South Africa. He has 2 sons.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.